Should have done that. That's why we have to. And Pat, do you agree to be orally recorded?
That's fine. Yes, that's fine.
Alrighty, great. Okay, so first of all, Pat, I'm just going to get some background information on you, if you don't mind. Pat, where were you born?
I was born in Keel, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, okay. And what year were you born?
43.
I usually get iffy about asking people that question, but...
1943.
Alrighty. When did you move to Detroit?
I moved to Detroit in 1967.
1967, okay. So, what made you move to Detroit?
I was in a seminary out in Plymouth, Michigan, mm-hmm. and I took a year off to live parish life, and I picked a parish in downtown Detroit.
Very nice. And then what convinced you to stay after the year?
I just made a home for myself. It was a great neighborhood and great people to share it with and live with.
And where was that
fell
parish?
In love with it.
That's beautiful. And where is that parish?
St. Patrick's Parish on Parsons.
Okay. Very nice. So, Pat, can you tell me a little bit about your upbringing? So, remind me again, you were born in...
Wisconsin.
What year?
43.
43, and you moved to 67.
Yeah.
Okay. So, can you describe a little bit of your upbringing, a little bit about your family life, your maybe siblings, what your parents did?
Yeah, I'm one of eight children.
Oh, wow. Big family.
I was raised on a dairy farm in Wisconsin.
Okay.
I left for seminary school after eighth grade.
Wow.
So, for the next 11 years, I was in seminary school, which is like a boarding school, you know, it's full-time.
Yeah. Wow.
And then in 67, I moved into Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Been here ever since. Love it.
Beautiful. And what did your parents do? What did your parents do? Excuse me.
My parents were dairy farmers.
Dairy farmers. Okay. Very nice. And so can you tell me a little bit about Detroit in 1967?
Well, it was... at the end of the riots,
mm-hmm.
I had come out here to distribute, help a parish distribute food to burnt out families,
mm-hmm.
Apartment buildings that were having trouble getting food to. And so we went out and delivered food baskets to the people that were affected by the riots.
Oh, okay. And was this part of like a program with your parish?
Yes.
All right, and how, like, can you describe the group to me? Was it just you, like a small group, or was it...
Yeah, just a couple people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and did that impact you in any way, the riots and that community involvement? Did that expose you to the community in a certain way?
I guess mostly just the fact that through all this so-called riot or revolution, depending on how you call it. As a person, as a white person, I had no problem navigating the black community and delivering food. I never felt threatened or anything like that. It was on the grassroots level. It was a much different scene than what the national press put it out to be.
And can you tell me a little bit about the contrast between the two? So, like, your firsthand account and what the national press?
That was really a long time ago.
Yeah. if you can give me something. If you can't, that's fine.
No, I just soon move on.
Okay. Alrighty. And...
that was a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so... so you stayed for that year in the parish group, and then afterwards, what did you do?
Well, I've stayed ever since. I've stayed down here ever since.
Okay. And I'm going to backtrack just a little bit and ask you about the Great Depression. So if you can tell me a little bit about how that impacted Detroit, specifically your community, and what demographics changed after that. Do you see any parallels to today, I know that's a lot of questions.
No, well, the Depression is long before mm-hmm. I came to Detroit.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So that's, the Depression was back in mm-hmm. the early 40s, so that may have affected my upbringing in that mm-hmm. we were very conservative with money. We didn't mm-hmm. like to extend credit or anything like that. I like to have things paid for.
Okay.
So personally, it probably did affect me,
mm-hmm.
but not.
So
what affected this neighborhood was in the earlier, but especially through the early 70s.
Yeah, that's what I was going to add. If,
yeah.
Yeah. How it.
This neighborhood was mostly made up of Appalachian whites
mm-hmm.
that were here in transition. They came up mm-hmm. from the south. They lived in this neighborhood is all apartment buildings. And so they lived in these apartment buildings, got a job in the big three, mm-hmm. and went to move out to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened in the early 70s was those jobs dried up.
Yeah.
So you lost the influx of new people coming in, but you retained all the people that by circumstance, money or whatever, couldn't afford or wouldn't leave our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the population declined, we had a situation where the rents weren't moving up,
mm-hmm.
where there weren't as many people in demand, and that a lot of the apartment owners were also retiring and moving to Florida.
Okay.
And so what happened was we had some outside investors come in,
mm-hmm.
and they would buy the building for a nominal fee
mm-hmm.
and then collect rent for like 2 years, do nothing to the building, not even pay utilities.
Wow.
And when they shut the utilities off, the tenants got mad, of course,
yeah.
and burned the building. But in the meantime, they had earned a great amount of money,
yeah.
and they just moved on to the next building.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So in the early 70s, we lost, I would say, almost half the buildings in the neighborhood. And we lost probably over half the population just in the early 70s. There were 10 times as many people when I came here as there are now, even after starting to rebuild. There were four-story apartment buildings that went from street to alley, and they were full. I mean, there was nothing surprising to have 100 kids in a building.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a much different place than it was later on. And that took a tremendous toll on everything in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then the city kind of deemed it Skid Row, because there were a lot of bars at the time on mm-hmm. Third. And so that added to the reputation of just a downtrodden neighborhood
mm-hmm.
for a lot of people.
Okay.
There was still a large core of people that believed in the Cass Corridor and still
yeah.
believe in the Cass Corridor and made it through. Enjoyed it. I enjoyed my whole time, all the years I spent here.
That's really good to hear. It seems like you're very proud.
I am.
Of your time here, and that's good. That's valuable. I actually want to backtrack. I realize I forgot to ask you one question. What do you consider, like, I guess, the parameters of Cass Corridor? So what apartment buildings does that include?
Well, it would go down to the Fisher
mm-hmm.
on the south.
Mm-hmm.
On the east side, it would be Woodward.
Mm-hmm.
West side would be the expressway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the north would be up in Warren.
Okay.
Up to Wayne State.
Okay, yep. You might have to help me catch a bus back there because I don't know how to get back that way. So let me see here. So let's move on to the Cass Corridor and development. So when did the CCNDC like establish itself?
Well, actually, it was there was a group in the neighborhood known as the Four C's,
mm-hmm.
the Concerned Citizens of the Cass Corridor.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That had tried to bridge the relationship between tenants and landowners mm-hmm. and black and white. And during this time, there was a building on Charlotte,
mm-hmm.
and next to the Masonic Temple,
mm-hmm.
and the tenants were being evicted by neglect.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the owner decided not to do any improvement
mm-hmm.
to allow the furnace to get stolen,
mm-hmm.
and with the hope that he could then make more money selling it to Masonic Temple. Masonic Temple wanted to make an asphalt parking lot all the way around their building for protection and get rid of people. So the neighborhood group decided to take that mission on and renovate that building and save it for the tenants that were there.
Wow.
And that was the founding of Cass Corridor Neighborhood Development Corporation.
And what year was that?
That was in 1982.
1982.
So with that, we were able to form a housing subcommittee,
mm-hmm.
and they renovated the building, got some grants, and moved the people. The people stayed, and we stabilized that building. And then after that, the Housing Commission kind of took over the organization,
mm-hmm.
and we've since bought, renovated, or built 350 units of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
To keep with our philosophy of improve housing, improve quality of life,
mm-hmm.
and our general philosophy of if you're going to have a good neighborhood, you have to have a mixed neighborhood.
Yeah.
And that's what I found when I got here, because it was a mix not only of black and white, but all nationalities.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of buildings that people came from India, all over, to mm-hmm. be part of the medical center in Wayne State, mm-hmm. and that was a very big advantageous thing.
Mm-hmm.
When my children started school at Burton, the local community school,
mm-hmm.
there were 18 different first languages spoke at this school.
Wow.
And that was very helpful to get a world view and
mm-hmm.
broaden horizons and
yeah.
all that stuff.
Yeah, I think my professor had to go through your daughter. I'm not sure what her name is. To get a hold of you, because I kept calling in here, but I know that you're busy and you're just, you're always moving around. So, I think my professor tried to get a hold of your daughter.
Right, she did.
Yeah. So, let's move down.
She lives here too.
Oh, does she?
Yeah.
Very nice. So, as of now, can you give me... I guess the demographic makeup, like what major minority groups live here, would you say would be in the highest numbers?
That's changed a lot,
mm-hmm.
and there isn't any one group now
mm-hmm.
that is, we had a huge Chinese contingent, and that's pretty much dispersed all over due to the change in the restaurant business. They moved
mm-hmm.
out and divided into each suburb to open their own stores.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be seven Chinese restaurants in mm-hmm. this neighborhood.
Yeah, I think there's only one now. I wrote it down. It's like
Shangri-La,
I think it's called.
Shangri-La, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So
none of the original ones are here anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, we had the dragon and the parade for New Year's down the streets,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, we had all that culture.
Yep. I've seen, there's a book on the Cass Corridor. It's actually your featured, your picture is
right.
in it. It's, who was it? His name is Keith Elias, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he's a Cass Corridor resident, so longtime resident. And he came to do a presentation for Kim's class, so
right.
yeah, we were able to see those pictures, and he showed us like the new Chinese restaurant opening, and
he opened a store, a restaurant
yeah.
himself.
I think it's a taco restaurant.
No, it's small plates. I forget the name of it, but it's.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a franchise. It's his own.
Oh, okay.
Spanish
yeah.
restaurant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. That's right. I remember like the picture of it. So, and this is actually something I looked up yesterday in the archives, and I wanted to ask you about. So this goes back to the 70s, and it's about the Native American community that was living MCAS quarter, I believe it was about like 2,000 of them, I think, throughout between the 70s and 80s that were residents here.
Yes.
And so I was looking through their the Native Son newsletter, and I was just wondering about the monitoring and the police brutality that they were organizing against. And could you just tell me more about that?
Well, there was a large Native American population throughout the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at Burton School, which was the focal point of this neighborhood, they had a lot of their powwows and different events. And police brutality was not just against Native Americans. It was against anybody in this neighborhood. It was called the Big Four.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Judge, jury, and executioner.
Yeah.
Coleman Young put a stop to all that. Yes, when I was started here, I ran a youth center.
Mm-hmm.
And I was harassed constantly because I had black and white youth in the van, and they thought obviously there was something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be stopped constantly and got out and frisked and the whole car examined. But because I was working, they found out I was working for a church and I was white, I was never personally beat up they just had to finish the search and then they had to let me go.
Mm-hmm.
But other kids, it was not unusual for the Big Four to take them in the back alley and beat them up a bit to get their point across.
Yeah.
Wayne State was also very anti-neighborhood at the time. Their police were just as bad as Detroit police. When we went to demonstrate in order for the youth to use Wayne State's facilities like swimming pools and fields, which they have to do by law, they brought out the whole riot squad.
Wow, and what year was that?
That had to be between 69 and 68 to 72, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I noticed I did my undergrad at U of M, and that was such a hot spot for activism in the 60s. And I noticed that a lot of the archives and someone actually mentioned this in my class yesterday, are closed off. So all those records of like student groups and like the demands and their newsletters and their statements, and it's like kind of sealed off from the public. And if you look at like the websites, they have a very different version of what happened. So you'd like talk to certain people who were organizing back then, and then you look at like their newsletters and their paperwork and whatnot and their demands, and then you look at like the U of M website and what they say about their activism is completely different. But
Well, it was organized because they built Mathai Field back then.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, what they did is they condemned a lot of houses that were.
This is Wayne State.
Yeah,
just to
Wayne
off.
State condemned a lot of houses,
mm-hmm.
and those they couldn't get. They got through neglect, and I personally went over and to see a fire, and we smelled gasoline on the way.
Oh.
And that house burned. And they had three fires on that particular day. And the general feeling in the neighborhood was that Wayne State was going to get that land by any means possible. They didn't personally set fires, but they knew real estate people. And real estate people knew that if the house was burnt, they could buy it and make a profit and sell it to... So they were co-conspirators, in my opinion, at the time. Now that's all changed 100%. I mean, Chief Holt now is like the most supportive person of people in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the university has changed, even in their architecture. Their architecture was one that they had everything blocked up on the first floor, so that, and tried to discourage by street cutting and everything, anybody from the neighborhood to come on their campus.
Oh, okay.
Because that was their idea of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a general feeling
of
safety, was to keep people away.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now they've graduated to the point where people are your safety, and windows on the first floor is what makes you safe.
Mm-hmm.
The more eyes you have, the safer you are.
Yeah.
So there's a big revolution and change in neighborhood, university.
Mm-hmm.
This whole idea of now that we're working together is just really what's just sparked a growth and a change in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I was actually, my Wayne State questions were all the way to the back, but since we're talking about it now, you brought up a lot of good points and two things I want to ask. So first off, what do you think gave people who are not residents of Cass Corridor that image of Cass Corridor of being dangerous or unsafe or something that they had to in some ways act against?
Well, there were a lot of things that went into that. The fact there were a lot of bars on Third.
Oh yeah, that's right, you mentioned
that. And prostitution was allowed in this
mm-hmm.
neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing was the news and Free Press were just a couple blocks south.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever the drinking reporters needed a story quick,
yeah,
they just came up to the corridor.
Oh, okay.
And they had a quick, easy story. So it all fed, one fed into the other.
Okay.
And then it just became like a whirlwind. And,
wow. Wow.
They could do that. And then the fact that the population was very, very poor
mm-hmm.
at that time, because the people that could leave had left.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had the leftovers,
mm-hmm.
yeah. less valued by society
yeah.
here. They
exactly.
were easy to pick on because they had no political clout.
Yeah.
And it was an easy story. So they did it. And at the same time, you wanted, real estate was encouraging people to buy in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing helps you buy in the suburbs as fear of the city.
Yeah.
And they could just stroke that fear.
Wow.
So that's what was going on.
Very much a redefining of the Cass Corridor character,
yeah.
I guess you would say. So I'm going to just go down this list really quickly. And so can you tell me a little bit about what it takes to be a member of the Cass Corridor? Like, what kind of requirements are there to live in one of the apartment buildings?
Well,
so I know they're low-income housing, so
the Cass Corridor neighborhood developments are affordable housing units,
mm-hmm.
which
you.
Means that you have to, we get tax credits to develop these properties.
Mm-hmm.
That's our source of funding for most of our buildings.
Okay.
Which comes with the regulations. You have to make enough money to be able to afford the rent and utilities,
mm-hmm.
but you can't make more than a set limit, which is usually between 40 to 60% of AMI. So
AMI is?
The average income. Of
income,
the,
okay.
So like, just a typical example would be a family of two, you couldn't be making more than $30,000,
mm-hmm.
and you couldn't be a Wayne State student.
Oh, okay.
This is not student housing, this is mm-hmm. housing. Wayne State has their own housing authority,
yeah.
so they don't mix. The thing that is stabilizing for the community is that once you qualify at that rate,
mm-hmm.
if you get a raise in your salary,
mm-hmm.
even double, you can stay.
Oh, okay.
Once you've qualified to stay, you can stay. And that has stabilized the neighborhood and achieved the other goal of opening up units, because
mm-hmm.
people that make like 3-4 times what they did when they moved here sometimes will move on to other places,
mm-hmm.
so that empties up another unit.
Mm-hmm.
But also enough people that really love the neighborhood and are comfortable stay,
mm-hmm.
and that helps the stability of the neighborhood and the continuity of the neighborhood.
So let's say their salary like triples and they decide to stay, does their rent go up?
No. No, the rent stays the same.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's a neat package, ain't it?
Well, yeah. So now I wanted to ask, are there any Wayne, do you have a population of Wayne students that decide to live here versus university housing?
No, we could only accept
Oh, you don't accept
Wayne State? We can't accept Wayne State students.
And why is that, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, because Wayne State has, in the federal tax code, mm-hmm. universities have their own sources of funding.
Okay.
So in other words, we're not going to draw from that population, and they're not, so...
Okay, I see. That makes sense.
They can't cross-fund, you know, you can't... Mm-hmm. University can't get tax grants for the neighborhood and the university, so...
Gotcha. So, by the way, Pat, has your position always been the executive director?
No, I was... First, I worked for the church for a couple of years, and then mm-hmm. I was a roofer for most of my life.
A what?
A roofing company.
Oh, a roofer. Okay.
Yeah.
Very nice. And so...
I just started... I was chairman of the board for a number of years, mm-hmm. and then I became executive director 15 years ago.
15 years ago. Okay. Very nice. So... Can you tell me about any major shifts that you've seen in the development of the CCNDC and the CAS corridor? Like, how is the organization of this group reflected onto the CAS corridor? So, I guess to clarify, how do you incorporate the tenants into the decision-making process? And have you seen any major shifts with, you know, with, I guess, the fluctuating populations at all?
Or? Well, our board of, we have a board of directors.
Yeah.
And they're made up of some of the tenants of okay. our buildings, plus some experts. And that always keeps us in tune. And then mm-hmm. we listen to the the tenants, you know, complaints, discussions, and we have different discussion meetings, tenant meetings, so we get to hear it. How it changes is the banks and the lending institutions did not loan any money to this neighborhood for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Nobody could get a loan in this neighborhood.
What year was it that you got the first loan? I think I read it somewhere online.
Yeah, the first loan was about 90.
90?
Okay. Yeah. We got a loan to do apartment building on Alexandria. Mm-hmm. And then that's the first time that a mortgage was granted in this neighborhood. And then based on that, other people started getting mortgages. So that, what we did was stabilize the decay. Mm-hmm. So stop the decay, renovate some buildings. And that was profitable. And it could be done. And that stopped the deterioration.
Yeah, and the people.
And then we started stabilizing, you know, block after block. Mm-hmm. And then now, mostly through Midtown Development, the for-profit is now moving, using much the same technique, mm-hmm. moving south and fulfilling. And we work together because it takes a whole variety of people.
Yeah, it does.
you can't run a city and just rich people or just poor yeah. people. You have to have a mix to make it a healthy, mm-hmm. good neighborhood. When I came here, there was a good mix of not only nationalities, but there were very limousine service next to a soup kitchen. I mean, there was a great tolerance, was the main thing that drew me to this neighborhood.
Wow.
Of all, there was a certain amount of honesty, mm-hmm. of not putting on airs, like pretending I have a big house and therefore I'm a good person, to like, okay, I'm not such a good person, but I'm still lovable and the neighborhood accepted me type mentality here. Mm-hmm. So artists were really well accepted, okay. and they were big on the north end of the CAS corridor. Mm-hmm. They got world renown, and it was just open to a whole lot of different. There's an open-mindedness that isn't found in many places.
Yeah, yeah.
And we wish to preserve that.
Mm-hmm. You know why I asked you about the organization of the I guess administration and how you interact with the tenants? Because I usually see, I'll give nonprofits throw them under the bus now. Just as an example, you usually see nonprofits serving a certain population, but that population is usually little to almost never involved in the planning or the implementation of whatever their mission is. So it's very, very much like top to bottom versus bottom up. But so when I was reading online, I was interested in how the community functioned here. And I know you guys have a community center, and like you said, you have meetings and you have functions. Like, I was looking through newsletters. They were, they were like a decade old, but I'm sure like these type of things still happen. Like Halloween parties, like bring your kids yeah. here, and like the,
I think the entry ticket.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can come and see it for yourself.
Oh, I would love to. I hope I can make it. I'll let you know. I'll keep you updated. Like the entry ticket for the Halloween party would be like a bag of candy
yes.
that people would share. And I just found that to be like very different, I guess.
Well, the thought that goes behind that
mm-hmm.
is there's so many do-gooders
mm-hmm.
who... And once you start doing that,
mm-hmm.
then people expect that you get everything for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to change the do-gooding attitude and the expectations.
Yeah.
And what you do is you have a big party, but it's not for free.
Yeah.
You have to bring a big bag of candy,
mm-hmm.
which is going to get divided and given back to all the kids.
Yeah.
So you contribute. You're part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially seniors found that hard to get used to.
Mm.
But they've grown, and they do it.
Interesting.
So... they bring the big bag of candy now. That's your entrance fee. You have contributed. You are part of it.
Yeah.
And then everybody benefits from it because the candy is going to be distributed to all the kids before they leave.
Very nice.
There's a lot of thought that goes behind a lot of stuff we do.
And I just found that to be like a very simple, beautiful thing. And like you said, there's a thought behind it. There's a reason for it. So...
even at this Christmas party, we have on there, bring a dessert to share. So you are mm-hmm. part of, or you have the opportunity to be part of whatever
the
we're doing.
Yeah. So let's see. So I guess, can you tell me about some major developments that you've seen? I know this is like a long span of time. Major developments in Detroit that you think stood out to you since you first moved here?
Well, I think the M1 rail is going to be a big change because now that enables you, given the economic climate of Detroit and the disparity between rich and poor, the number of cars that people can afford from reasons of insurance and lack of income is dropping drastically over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have an apartment building right next door that has a parking lot for 30 cars. 15 years ago when we opened that building, those parking spaces were all filled because people could be in affordable housing and own a car.
Yeah.
Now you can't very easily do that. So now instead of 30-some cars, we have two or three.
Mm.
And that all happened just in the last probably 7-8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a drastic shift. And so it's very important that public transportation take hold if we're going to build the city
mm-hmm.
and bring back the density that once was. That's essential if you're going to have a city.
Yeah. Interesting.
So we're very dedicated to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I as a graduate student, I can tell you it's not easy having to like maintain a car, pay the insurance, and then I always say it's more expensive to be poor.
Because, yes, definitely. Many times over.
Because you have to buy, you know, a not so updated car. And you end up spending you can't even pay the insurance, and then you end up spending the money on fixing it every month when it breaks down. And then
you spend more money for bad food.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all those areas have to be, drastically improved. You know, Eastern Market's a big part of that. I go there every week. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just part of our...
And where is that, Eastern Market?
Eastern Market is just about 2 miles down Mac.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't been to Eastern Market, you should be ashamed.
Hold on. Eastern, describe it to me.
It's just a Saturday morning, a big open market where all the farmers bring in all their produce. And
oh, really?
Yes, and it's straight. You buy it right from the farmer.
Mm-hmm.
So everything you could possibly want in food that's not canned is there.
Interesting.
You can buy a whole pig down to a couple seeds.
Interesting.
If you want some seeds, or you want the fresh beans or fresh beets. Or
yeah, Ann Arbor has a lot of like farmers markets now, so now I've gotten
they're all based on Eastern Market. Eastern Market's been there for 100 years.
Really?
Nonstop. Over 100 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's the oldest inner city market in the United States.
Interesting.
They even have slaughterhouses there, and they have wholesale. So they have the whole gamut. It's a whole community.
But is there an Amish community that sells their, like, poultry?
There are a couple Amish farmers that come there.
Interesting. Yeah, there are some
Canadian farmers that come. There's
really? And this is every
from
Saturday
Ohio
morning?
Ohio that come up, and they come from all over. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, then I'll definitely have to check that out.
You definitely have to. You've missed a big cultural point in
I
your
have.
Development.
I need to leave Ann Arbor for a little bit, I think.
Yes. So where are you originally from?
So, you know, it's funny. I used to live in Hamtramck, so lived there for a year, and I moved, we moved around a little bit, moved to Dearborn, and then when I started high school, we moved to Ann Arbor. So it's like blocks in different, in different times of my life. But I have a special place for like the South End, the Hamtramck area. So Ann Arbor is very, very different, obviously, from Dearborn. So yeah. I don't know. I haven't been too involved in Detroit. It's even though I'm a grad student at Wayne State, I still feel like I don't know the streets. I don't know. I don't know the areas because I feel like Wayne State kind of, I don't want to say purposely or, you know, with intent, kind of closes itself off or tries to at least. And I feel like I get that when I read about Wayne State or read their like newsletters and things because of safety. So people always have this idea of, oh my God, a university in the middle of Detroit. And so I think they try to do that in terms of kind of reassuring people that it is a safe campus.
Reassuring your parents.
Yeah, reassuring, yep, exactly. And so I feel like I feel like when I ventured out here, I was like, this is completely different than campus life. Even when you venture outside of campus life, it's still kind of like closed off. You have like, you know, a couple blocks of businesses and that's what it is. And so I haven't ventured out as much, and I wish, I really, really hope to. As soon as it gets warm. Not right now. As soon as it gets warm, because I can't deal with the winter. So what do you think about that? What do you think about what I said about Wayne State?
You mean closing off?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're always trying to, they have to portray an image of safety. I mean, that's just part. But they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had graduation there last year, the year before, for the first time.
Wow.
That they invited, you know, they always
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, they always had it at, like, downtown,
mm-hmm.
at Cobo Hall.
Oh, okay.
For safety reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Just
interesting.
To make sure the parents would feel safe enough. Because there is that misconception of safety, you know, perception so much a part of everything.
Yeah.
That, I mean, when we started in our school, at Burton School, being part of the neighborhood, it had the same perception.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was K through sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And after sixth grade, the kids just quit. They didn't go any further.
Wow.
My wife went to the meetings when she was pregnant with our first child. And so, you know, if we're going to send our kid there, we got to do something about it.
Yeah.
And we formed a good neighborhood group and encouraged, and we kept the same teachers, but we changed the perception. We made it Burton International School, encouraged and extended it to eighth grade. And when we changed the name and talked about the perception changed, we had more applicants than we could possibly.
Wow.
In a 3-year period, we went from a couple hundred to 800 applicants.
Wow.
And then we had to put limits on who we could accept, you know. First the neighborhood came, and then we divided among the different ethnic groups the remaining slots. And it was all perception. It was the same school. It was the same neighborhood. We did not change. We didn't kick any teachers out.
Mm-hmm.
We could add teachers because we added students.
Yeah.
But we made a multicultural curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you had, we had ethnic days where each classroom became a country.
Oh, yeah.
And the students, like the students from Pakistan, did their ethnic clothes, dress, and all that.
Yeah.
And the Chinese, and each group, 7 or 8 countries were represented. And you went, you got a passport when you came
in. Yeah, I did that too.
And you went around to each of the... each of the classrooms.
The classrooms were a different country. Yeah, that's so beautiful.
And then we tried to get the curriculum also, like you're doing geography, you would do the geography of, and then the English teacher would stories. And then the English teacher looked at the papers and found out the 7th graders had the exact same story about Pakistan, as the Pakistani students had the same story as the American students.
Yeah.
And you realize that you did not value your background. So you assumed the background, everybody assumed the background of what they thought the teacher wanted, even in 7th grade. And so I went back and said, no, tell us your experience. And then they... from each country, they use those reports to talk about the geography, the jobs, the stuff. So, yeah, it was educational for parents. Yeah. It was educational for all the students, and it became a very magical time. It was great.
That's so nice. So it sounds like it was well received. It sounds.
Oh
like
yeah, it was just totally exciting.
That's amazing.
I mean, I was the chairperson for the parent group, and to this day, students come back and talk to me about the best event in their lives.
That's amazing.
And they're from all over the world. Now, they've gone all over the world because of the multicultural. They're not scared of anything.
So are you still involved in that group?
No, because of environmental reasons, they shut that school down.
Okay.
And they moved the... they moved it to another neighborhood.
Okay.
But it was really made for this neighborhood.
Wow.
Because just by circumstance, we had all the ingredients.
Yeah.
It's an international school, but if it's in one ethnic neighborhood, it's going to become all that ethnicity. Just by happen chance.
I love that. And that's so, it's good for the students too.
Oh,
it's really beneficial
for
the students. Because I think as they get, I mean, I can speak from experience, and like with everything happening at universities now, the issues that students of color face, I mean, from when they're in kindergarten and on, you always hear like new stories about things. Like, I think maybe 2 months ago there was, a Native American boy that wears his hair as a mohawk, and he was literally like, you know, he's 5 years old, and what is he said, this is how the men in my tribe wear our hair, and he was sent home until he changed, until he cut off his
small
mohawk.
See, we encouraged that, and we didn't have a dress code.
Oh, okay.
And what was so neat was that it didn't matter if you were an Appalachian with overalls and had a couple holes in your pants, because that guy next to you had a turban, and the little girl next to you had a long dress, and, you know, there was no way to pick on. Because there was so many, and the community and the teachers pushed for acceptance, too. I mean, it was part of nobody was claiming their mm-hmm. control over the school.
That really resonates with me. I really wish that people would recognize how important it is for children to experience these things, and also how students of color, what they're going to be facing later on in life, and to kind of to give them that voice when they're younger, and to allow them to be just to be able to be comfortable in their skin and not have to worry is a very interesting thing to me.
It was very interesting in that one of the most astounding things that the students always did reports for the parents too,
mm-hmm.
and they did like every student a genealogy,
mm-hmm.
right? So two students, one black, one white, and did a genealogy. And one traced their family back to slaves, and the other as a slave owner.
Wow.
But it was an intellectual discussion at seventh grade.
Wow.
There was no, oh, you whites, or oh, you blacks.
Mm-hmm.
It was, oh, look at our forefathers. We're the same,
yeah.
but our forefathers did these yeah. strange things. It was just, it was so neat.
Wow. That not only resonates with me, but that's just very reflective of how...
I mean, you can get past those things.
Yeah.
You can. Yeah. Acknowledge that you sin and get past it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's reflective in the way, I guess, that you and your team run this place. That ideology is very important. So... I guess we're going to break and then go to...
No, can't break too long because we've got to get going.
Oh, no, I mean break as in my thought process.
Okay.
We're going to move on, sorry. I guess if you could tell me a little bit about the redevelopment. So if I understand correctly, there was a $60 million contract and Cass Corder was able to buy a bunch of apartment buildings. I believe this was last year. This was approved.
You got it all wrong.
Do I got it all wrong? Okay, well, you got to clarify for me, Pat. I'm it's so funny because I'm Googling and trying to pick things out.
Nobody gives, first of all, nobody gives a nonprofit these days anything. They just don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fallacy, we're a nonprofit, so people are going to give us a lot of money.
Yeah.
So we acquired a building. It's right across the street. You can see we're renovating it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to get that building for a nominal amount because it had been vacant for a long time.
Okay.
And then we applied for tax credit
mm-hmm.
and grants to redevelop the building. So
mm-hmm.
and you get tax credits and historical tax credits, everything we could find that contribute to redeveloping housing. We put those all together in a pot.
Mm-hmm.
And then we developed that building, and the cost of that was $16 million.
Sixteen.
Not 60.
Oh yeah. 16.
16. And so, in a couple months we'll have those 47 units ready.
47.
For occupancy. And so that'll be part of the Cass Corder affordable housing
mm-hmm.
program.
Beautiful. So is it just that building with 47 units?
There's two buildings. One is 39 and one is 8.
Okay.
The one with 8 is already done.
Okay. And are you accepting new applicants?
The one that we finished with the 8,
mm-hmm.
we opened up. That was leased up, and the day we got our CFO
mm-hmm.
was at 2 o'clock on a Friday,
mm-hmm.
and Saturday all 8 people were moved in.
Wow.
The demand is 10 times what we have. If we had another 500 units, we could fill them in no time.
Wow.
There's just such a demand.
That's how you know it's working.
So, yeah.
Beautiful. So, now to talk more of the business side. What kind of businesses do you see popping up around here? So I know Shangri-La, K9 to 5, which is right there, the Goodwill's Market, and Textures by Nefertiti. So I looked up a couple places. But are you seeing any more business popping up around here? Any of the tenants that have given you ideas, maybe are starting things up, maybe their own businesses up?
Well, some of the, most of our tenants either work for, they're not starting businesses, they're working for people mm-hmm. in business with the hope of opening up their own businesses. And there are some that have opened up hair salons and things like that, but it takes big capital to
open
up general buildings. So mm-hmm. a lot of our tenants work in the restaurants and in the hospital complex,
yep.
at Wayne, at the casino. So this is a, has always been a working class neighborhood between downtown and the stuff on the boulevard. And it's staying that way and becoming more so. There'll be a new business opening up. I mean, just the fact that we're making a city.
Yeah.
We're more, there's more opportunities for mm-hmm. different types of businesses. So, yeah, we see a lot of business opening up.
Okay. Interesting. And so do you help your tenants with finding jobs around the city?
We're not that big.
Okay.
We're a very small organization. So, I mean, by chance we do, mm-hmm. but it's not something that we don't have an employment
department. Yeah, I was just going to get a service or something.
Yeah.
So, and so with the talks of like development, and I know you've talked to me a little bit about the city of Detroit, but what's your relationship with the city of Detroit in general and in terms of the redevelopment plans?
Well, we have a very good cooperative working relationship with the city. We get some city money as part of the development of, mm-hmm. Of our projects. And they've been very supportive of what we're doing, have been for a long time. So, yeah.
And when do you think, like what year, can you give me a time of when your relationship with the city of Detroit really like solidified, I guess?
Probably... in the late 90s.
Late 90s. There.
Yeah. I mean, maybe even longer. Probably the beginning of the 80s. Coleman Young was a good partner with us.
Mm-hmm.
The first mayor that we worked with.
Very nice. Let's see. We can... I'm looking over a couple of these questions. I feel like you've already answered a lot of these. Yeah, I feel like you... You know, I actually have a quick question about Preservation Wayne. Are you involved with that group at all?
No.
No? Okay. I just
wanted to... We do a lot of preservation, but, mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of our thing, but no, I'm not personally involved in it.
Okay.
That's Kim's bag.
That's right.
That I work with Kim on safety in the neighborhood.
Oh,
we work on the same Midtown Alliance group that brings in all the different enforcement of police and mm-hmm. and cleanliness to make the neighborhood a better place. And she's chairperson mm-hmm. of that.
Oh, interesting.
And when she's not when she can't chair because of illness, then I chair.
Oh, okay.
So we have great cooperation.
That's
between.
Great. I feel like she's mentioned that to me before in her office hours.
She's a very good.
She's a great professor.
Pusher of the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Supporter of the neighborhood.
Yeah, I can tell when I talk to her in office hours. She seems involved.
Yes.
Very involved in the community. And I think you get that with, like, professors that appreciate oral history. they're just a different breed of professors, I guess you would say. They appreciate that bottom-up method. They appreciate people's stories and narratives and know that there are different narratives.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who you listen to is a much different perception of this neighborhood if you're an old Wayne State person and an old neighborhood person.
Yeah. All right. You know what? We have about 5 minutes left. I guess I can just wrap up with with these, so we're in. Okay. So, what do you hope for Kess Corridor as a whole, for its future and for the future residents and the tenants that you have now?
My hope is that this neighborhood continues to grow in numbers, and that those numbers are very tolerant of each other, mm-hmm. and that there's always acceptance for people of means and people without means, and whatever group wishes to be the next group to be dominant or be the most, that they're accepted and they accept the history of the neighborhood that's been here. Mm-hmm. So, just one big happy family.
One big happy family.
But it has to be a diverse family.
Yeah.
It cannot be. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than all rich people because they have nothing to lose, so they think they have nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than an all poor neighborhood because they have nothing to lose, so you have no bargaining chip.
Yeah.
What you need is a mix of all peoples, mm-hmm. and a few of the rich and a few of the very poor. Mm-hmm. But we can't take all the poor, we can't take all the rich, otherwise we'll destroy our neighborhood. Either one is by itself is not good for a neighborhood.
It's very business savvy of you.
Just reality of, you can extrapolate that to a nation.
Yeah. And so, what was I going to follow up with that? It seems like you have a great team. Like, there's so much history in this neighborhood. I didn't realize it until that presentation. And, like, I actually wasn't aware that I had heard of, like, Cass Corridor, but I always heard it as, like, Midtown. That's what I always assumed.
Just to get it straight in your head, this is the Cass Corridor. Mm-hmm. It's the very heart of Midtown, which is a big circle. The Cass Corridor is the heart of it, and it is the source of its strength.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where it started.
Beautiful. And, so that's what I'm saying. It has a legacy to it. And yes. I think that with the
and
team...
people have loved it all the way through. Yeah. It's not something that just happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's been here forever. I mean, you know, when they stole the land from the Indians and gave it to Cass,
mm-hmm.
who was the governor at the time.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, I just think that, like, the mission and the way that it's implemented... it's just very remarkable. So I feel like in that way, and I hope and pray that continues, that it's sustained. And so, so my final question to you is, what has been the most rewarding event for you? You can name one, you can name all of them. if you can pick one.
The most rewarding part of being in this neighborhood has been that all my children have gotten a great education here,
mm-hmm.
and were well equipped to go out to university, mm-hmm. and out into the world and be successful,
mm-hmm.
and are very comfortable with moving back and living here and raising their children here.
Wow.
And are very proud of their neighborhood and I think are very balanced and are good citizens.
Beautiful.
And, I think the neighborhood I got more than I gave to this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel very blessed and lucky to have been here.
Beautiful.
And have gone through all the stuff. So, yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Pat?
I think that's pretty much.
Alrighty. Perfect. Well, I just wanted to say this was very, very insightful. I'm very happy and blessed that you are my interviewee that can assign me to you. Thank you so much for your time. I will be in touch because I'm very interested. So maybe that Christmas party on Friday, I hope. It's finals week, so I'm just like all over the place. So.
Well, I'm glad you got your paper done before finals.
Thank you. Thank you. Alrighty, Pat, I'm going to stop the recording now. I'm just going to save it really quickly before... my luck, I'm like half asleep right now, then I'll just delete it by accident or something.
Yeah, you want to do this again.
And